regime's occupation of the Palestinians, now over 50 years old, has become illegal. The language forbidding the transfer of population from the occupying state to occupied territory was adopted into Rome Statute, the Charter of the International Criminal Court, established in 2002 at The Hague, which has been signed by 139 countries and fully ratified as national law by 123. The International Criminal Court has begun an investigation of the Zionist regime war crimes in the occupied Palestinian territories.
It all started in November 2017 when Saudi forces detained dozens of royals and business people and imprisoned them inside the Ritz-Carlton Hotel in Riyadh under the pretext of an anti-corruption drive ordered by the newly appointed Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman, also known as MBS. He has gone to great lengths to consolidate power and eliminate potential rivals ever since. On March 6, 2020, Mohammed bin Nayef, Saudi Arabia's former crown prince, was detained on the charge of treason. Saad al-Jabri, a former Saudi spy master and bin Nayef's longtime aide, is the latest high-profile figure caught in the heated rivalry. Jabri alleged in a lawsuit last year that MBS sent a, quote, tiger squad to assassinate him in Canada, where he lives in exile. He also said the crown prince detained his two children to pressure him to go back home. Two lawsuits filed by Saudi state-run companies are accusing Jabri of embezzlement. The firms are part of a network providing cover for clandestine operations with the U.S. Court documents show Jabri intends to make revelations that include matters related to, quote, U.S. national security activities, raising concerns inside Washington and prompting the U.S. to consider a rare judicial intervention.
When it was revealed that the Crown Prince had sent his assassin squads to Canada to assassinate one of his former security aides, people just became more alarmed that another repeat of the Khashoggi drama was unfolding. And it is not a joke, these threats to assassinate opposition figures by some Gulf countries is a very serious business.
Jamal Khashoggi was a Saudi dissident journalist who was killed and dismembered at the kingdom's embassy in Istanbul in October 2018. From Yemen to Istanbul, Saudi Arabia has left a trail of bodies behind. But that's not to say it doesn't target its people within the confines of its borders.
The Saudis have always had a bleak record on human rights. Their record is simply black. They arrest people for expressing their opinion. They kill, they behead and crucify opponents for the smallest of things, for criticizing the regime, for asking to improve their own lives.
As MBS kicked off his campaign of crackdown on dissent, he announced a series of social reforms, including the so-called women's rights reforms, lifting bans on driving and travel restrictions. Amid all the fanfare, however, the kingdom launched a tougher crackdown on women's rights activists, raising questions about Riyadh's intentions in announcing the reforms. Just weeks before the Saudi government lifted the ban on women's driving, Lujain al-Hathloul, an activist who campaigned for women's driving rights, was detained. A prison guard working in a Dahban central prison has given an account of how female prisoners, including al-Hathloul, were and are being tortured. The guard has said that inmates are subjected to violent treatments, including electric shocks, beatings, whippings, and sexual assaults.
treatment amounts to crimes against humanity. They are considered crimes of against humanity, whether it is torture, whether it is arbitrary detention, whether it is extrajudicial killing.
U.S. President Joe Biden vowed earlier this year to press Saudi Arabia over its rights records, but later decided not to penalize the kingdom for assassinating Khashoggi. If the violators of human rights aren't held accountable, doesn't that embolden them to think they can carry on and get away with murder in its most literal sense?
The Mujahideen Khalq group sided with the Iraqi dictator Saddam Hussein when the Ba'athist regime attacked Iran in 1980. The group claims to have fought for the Iranian people, yet it has the blood of thousands of Iranian civilians on its hands. This year, the annual three-day meeting of the MKO terrorist group is hosted by Albania. The group gathers hired supporters among several former and current American and European officials to deliver paid speeches. This year, several high-profile Western politicians, including Slovenian Prime Minister Janez Janša, a number of U.S. lawmakers, as well as former Secretary of State Mike Pompeo, are among invitees. The Slovenian Prime Minister Janez Janša also delivered a speech at the conference that drew harsh criticism from Iran and promoted the Iranian Foreign Ministry to summon the Slovenian ambassador to Tehran. In a statement on Sunday, the ministry slammed the Slovenian Prime Minister's move as unacceptable and undiplomatic. Angered by the participation of Iranians in the June presidential election, Pompeo claimed that the vote was a boycott.
The program of sanctions and pressure employed by the Trump administration needs to remain the model for engagement with Iran if we want to ensure the security of the American people and better lives for the Iranian people. In Washington, D.C., there is much consensus, as evidenced by the overwhelming support for the sanctions regime that we put into place.
In response, the Iranian Foreign Ministry spokesman said the MKO is a terrorist cult having the blood of Iranian people on its hands. Saeed Khatibzadeh denounced Western politicians, including Pompeo, for selling themselves cheap to the Europe-hosted circus. He also accused the West of shameful hypocrisy driven by an insatiable thirst for money and anti-Iran obsession.
Well, I think it's fairly obvious that the MKO is being supported by the Western countries because it is essentially carrying out imperialist interests. Obviously, the MKO is right there in design in order to overthrow the Iranian government and place some kind of cult activity inside the country. I mean, it's very clear that they're being used as a proxy force to fight the Iranian government.
Iran has always complained that the West's support for a terrorist group such as MKO violates the UN Charter and international norms. The Mujahideen Khalq organization has conducted numerous assassinations and bombings against Iranian statesmen and civilians since the 1979 victory of Iran's Islamic Revolution. Out of the nearly 17,000 Iranians killed in different terrorist attacks over the past four decades, about 12,000 of them have fallen victim to the MKO. MKO's rift with Iran worsened when its leader, Masoud Rajavi, aligned with former Iraqi dictator Saddam Hussein in the eight-year Iran-Iraq War in the 1980s. MKO received funding, weapons, ammunition, vehicles, and the use of land in exchange for its support for Saddam. Despite all the crimes committed by the MKO, it is not currently listed by any Western country as a terrorist organization. The European Union and the U.S. that often claim to be anti-terrorism rather removed the MKO from their lists of terror organizations in 2009 and 2012 respectively. Ever since, the West has changed its stance toward the MKO, propagating it not only as an opposition group, but misses no chance to fund the group and lobby in its favor by putting a blind eye to how the MKO spilled the blood of innocent people.
So this is a long-standing policy by the United States, and it shows that the U.S. is not interested in fighting terrorism whatsoever. They're very fond of being able to use terrorists to their own ends, to carry out their own means whenever it's in their interest to do so.
The West's support for the hated MKO group has added to a more feeling of distrust among Iranians toward the Western governments. West's support for a terrorist cult only exposes their double standards when it comes to terrorist organizations. Haiti's president Jovenel Moïse was killed during an attack on his private residence in the capital of Port-au-Prince on early Wednesday. Haiti's first lady was also wounded in the attack and evacuated to a hospital in Miami for treatment. She later accused enemies of sending mercenaries to kill the president and his family to thwart democratic changes in the country. That's why none of the Moïse's guards were injured in the attack. Moreover, Haitian officials have not yet provided a motive for the assassination or explained how the killers got past Moïse's security detail. Haitian police says they have identified 28 people in connection to the fatal shooting, of which two were U.S. citizens. The rest, all Colombian, remain at large. The Colombian Defense Ministry says initial findings suggest that several of the attackers have been retired members of the Colombian military. Colombian police have confirmed that four companies were involved in the assassination of the Haitian president. The companies recruited Colombian nationals who traveled to Haiti through the neighboring Dominican Republic. On the other hand, when pressed on reports that two Haitian Americans were involved with the assassination, the White House Press Secretary Jen Psaki declined to comment. This arouses suspicions about possible U.S. involvement. After all, the U.S. has a track record when it comes to these types of operations. In 2020, two U.S. citizens were arrested in Venezuela. The Venezuelan president, Nicolas Maduro, accused Washington of plotting to invade his country, overthrow, and assassinate him. Maduro claimed that the invaders were trained and funded by the U.S. and Colombia. Also, there was the infamous Bay of Pigs operation. 50 years ago, a group of some 1,500 Cuban exiles, trained and financed by the CIA, launched an ill-fated invasion of Cuba from the sea in the Bay of Pigs. The plan was to overthrow Fidel Castro and his revolution. Furthermore, the U.S. track record in Haiti speaks volumes in how the U.S. has treated the country. A simple history check reveals the deep U.S. involvement in this tiny island nation. In 1914, the U.S. sent Marines into Haiti. It gained complete control over Haitian finances and the right to intervene in Haiti whenever the U.S. government deemed necessary at the time. The U.S. government also forced the election of a new pro-American president by the Haitian legislature in August 1915. The selection of a president that did not represent the choice of the Haitian populace increased unrest in Haiti. Meanwhile, Haiti has been struggling with a wave of extreme violence, a growing humanitarian crisis, and a worsening coronavirus pandemic, and now the assassination of Moïse has thrown the country into deeper turmoil, as his death leaves a power vacuum.
However, we do know for sure the United States that this solves a lot of problems for the United States regarding its interest in Haiti and their support for Jovenel Moïse and that administration. It was an untenable situation. They had already been supporting him through a very suspect, abolishing of the Constitution. He extended his term. Now he was ruling by decree, and they were about to force on the Haitian people another election and a new constitution under very, circumstances in which the Haitian people didn't want. Clearly, the masses of Haitian people were in the street.
Haitian President Jovenel Moïse's death has led to confusion about who is the legitimate person to lead the country of 11 million people. Claude Joseph, who had resigned as prime minister, took charge of the government and named himself acting president in the hours after the assassination. Ariel Henry, whom Moïse had named prime minister but had not yet taken office, also claims he should be in charge. Furthermore, Joseph Lambert, who leads what remains of the Haitian Senate, joined two others seeking to rule the nation, announced that he was voted provisional president by his fellow senators Friday evening. With tensions high in the capital, crowds of people took to the streets Thursday night, burning cars and demanding justice. Meanwhile, the COVID-19 pandemic has been worsening in Haiti. According to the United Nations Children's Agency, Haiti was the only country in the Western Hemisphere to not have received a single dose of the COVID-19 vaccine. At the same time, according to the World Bank, the country is facing a dire economic situation. Its economy had shrunk further 3.8% in 2020, with about 60% of the population now living in poverty. Furthermore, according to UNICEF, more than 1.5 million children are currently in urgent need of humanitarian assistance in Haiti.
The United States is directly responsible for the situation, decidedly so. It's intentional to keep Haiti underdeveloped, to keep control of its resources and its labor and its markets under the control of foreign corporations.
With Haiti having a track record of interference from Western governments like the U.S. and France, it remains to be seen whether the country will be able to preserve any peace and stability as it goes through this transformation. Moïse's murder has prompted the government to call for U.S. and UN assistance. At this point, the U.S. has said it will only take necessary action to defend Americans and critical infrastructure.
Gun violence is killing more people in the U.S. state of New York than the COVID-19 pandemic. That's according to New York Governor Andrew Cuomo. He announced on Thursday that he has declared gun violence in New York a disaster emergency, making extra funding and resources available to combat shootings statewide. The first of its kind executive order came at a time when New York City and the country as a whole are struggling to curtail the spike in gun violence. Speaking during an event at John Jay College of Criminal Justice, Cuomo said his plan includes short-term and long-term measures that treat gun violence as a public health crisis. Cuomo said nearly $139 million will be invested in prevention and employment programs to help youth and keep at-risk young people off the streets.
Fact, gun violence discriminates. The way COVID discriminated, gun violence discriminates. When you look among the victims of gun violence nationally, 59% non-white. New York State, 68% non-white. New York City, 77% non-white. Think about that, 77%.
Well, these poor Black and Latino neighborhoods and people are likely to be victims because crime is rampant in these communities. But why is crime rampant in these communities? Well, as we see and we know, poverty exacerbates not only just gun violence, but all sorts of violence, petty theft, nonviolent crimes, drugs, gang violence. And these poor Black and Latino neighborhoods have been neglected by the government, by New York State, as well as their neighborhoods have been sold out. Gentrification throughout New York City is specifically targeting neighborhoods in Brooklyn, Queens, and the Bronx.
Cuomo also announced he was going to sign legislation that allows for civil lawsuits against gun manufacturers, distributors, and dealers for how they market and sell firearms. The governor added that over the 4th of July weekend, at least 51 people fell victim to gun violence across the U.S. state alone. U.S. President Joe Biden announced last month his plan to fight the rising gun crimes across the country.
Today, the department is announcing, as I just did, a major crackdown on stem the flow of guns used to commit violent crimes. It's zero tolerance for gun dealers who willfully violate key existing laws and regulations. Let me repeat, zero tolerance.
His plan includes allocating more funds to law enforcement agencies to improve their ability to track and disrupt gun trafficking. He's set to meet with the country's law enforcement, local elected officials, and advocates to discuss the plan on Monday. The White House says the $1.9 trillion COVID-19 relief package provides funding not only to the police, but also to programs such as youth employment, which can help reduce crime rates. the Democrats and Republicans are now pointing fingers at each other over soaring gun violence, with the GOPs criticizing Biden's performance in fighting crimes and Democrats blaming their political rivals for blocking their proposals on gun control.
The American obsession with guns at its root is because our founding fathers and the right have just made it part of the American identity, make it seem as if to be American is to own a gun, when being American is so much more than that. It's about working hard and defending your neighbor and, you know, wanting better for yourselves.
An FBI report in March pointed to a 25% increase in the number of homicide cases in 2020 compared to a year before. Figures suggest the rising trend has continued into 2021, fueling concerns that the U.S. could witness one of its highest numbers of homicides it has ever recorded this year.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
As the investigation into Ma's murder unfolds, the USA is laying the groundwork to deploy troops into Haiti for the fourth time in 106 years, at the request of a figure it has spent decades grooming, says Dan Cohen, journalist, in an article published under the heading Suspected Assassins of Haitian President Ma, trained by U.S. and linked to pro-coup oligarchy. Stay tuned for the details of this article, please. As shock grips the Caribbean island nation of Haiti following the assassination of President Moi, the Haitian government has carried out a campaign to arrest suspects it alleges are responsible for the murder. Haitian Director of National Police Leon Charles announced at a press conference that the assassination squad that killed Ma is comprised of 28 foreigners, including 2 Haitian Americans and 26 Colombian nationals. 15 of those Colombians have been detained, while 3 were killed in a gun battle and 8 remain fugitives. Colombian Defense Minister Diego Molano has admitted that some of the Colombians are retired military personnel. Among them are at least one highly decorated soldier who received training from the United States, and another has been implicated in the murder of Colombian civilians. The Haitian Americans have been identified as James Solages, 35, and Joseph Vincent, 55. Solages lives in Fort Lateral, where he is the CEO of EJS Maintenance and Repair and runs a non-profit group, the website of which has been scrubbed of information. Prior to relocating to Florida, he lived in southern Haitian coastal city of Jacmel. According to the Washington Post, Solages' Facebook profile, which has since been removed, listed him as the chief commander of bodyguards of the Canadian Embassy in Haiti. The Canadian Embassy confirmed that Solages previously worked as a security guard. While in Florida, Solages was an avid and vocal supporter of former President Michel Martelly, the founder of Moi Haitian Bald-Headed Party, PHTK, according to Tony Jean Tenor, leader of the VIO popular organization in Miami, founded by the late father Gerald Jean Just. The Haitian Times reported Solages also used to work as a security guard for both Reginald Bolos and Dimitri Vor, two prominent members of Haiti's tiny bourgeois. Although initially friendly to him, they both became bitter opponents of Ma. Bola was also a prominent supporter of previous coups in 1991 and 2004 against President Jean-Bertrand Aristide. The Bolos family is one of the wealthiest in Haiti and owns a pharmaceutical company that in 1996 was responsible for poisoning scores of children with its tainted fever medicine, some fatally. Since July 6 to 8, 2018, national uprising against the IMF dictated hike of fuel prices, Blow has attempted to recast himself as a popular and progressive figure after one of his stores was burnt and looted, heading a political party called the Third Way Movement, that is MTV. Worp is the executive director and vice president of Societe Generale d'Ingénieurs, SA, one of the largest private energy companies in Haiti, which had a sweetheart deal providing power to the energy grid that Moi sought to renegotiate after the collapse of Petrocaribe program, under which Venezuela provided Haiti with cheap oil and credit from 2008 to 2018. Many believe Bolos is the intellectual author and financial backer of Moi's murder. Solages' employment by Bolos and centrality to the operation appears to confirm the growing popular consensus in Haiti that this controversial merchant-turned-politician was the principal backer of Moi's assassination, explained journalist Kim Eves, continuing, "A lot of factors have been pointing to his involvement. The arrival of the mercenaries in 9 brand-new Nissan patrol vehicles without license plates suggests that they were vehicles coming from the Nissan leadership owned by Reginald Bolos. The Haitian people have already concluded that Bolos was behind the assassination and have de-checked or uprooted the dealership, Automeca, that he owned." While the Haitian Americans reportedly served as translators, the muscle of the assassination squad came from Colombia, the U.S. top regional ally, which serves as a platform for destabilization and regime change plots in the region from Venezuela to Ecuador, and now apparently Haiti. The most prominent member of the Hill Squad is Manuel Antonio Grosso Gurin, a 41-year-old former Special Operations Commando who retired from the military as a member of the Simon Bolivar No. 1 Infantry Battalion on December 31, 2019. According to the Colombian newspaper La Semana, Grosso had several special combat courses had been a member of the special forces and anti-guerrilla squads and was known for being a skilled paratrooper who flew through the air without fear. In 2013, Grosso was assigned to the Airborne Anti-Terrorist Special Force Group, a secretive elite military detachment dedicated to counter-terrorism operations and carrying out kidnappings and assassinations, euphemistically known as high-value target acquisition and elimination. This branch of the military is also tasked with providing security to VIP figures from the Colombian president to U.S. presidents Bill Clinton and George Bush. He was one of the most prepared, the source remarked to La Semna. Among Grosso's preparations was a special command instruction from the United States military, which supplies training and weapons to the Colombian military, one of the most repressive armed forces in the region and one that works to secure international corporate interests and drug trafficking routes. How many false positives? How many social leaders, how many signers of the peace accord will be on this man? Left-wing Colombian Senator Gustavo Bolivar commented on Twitter. Grosso was joined by Francisco Eladio Uribe Oca, who had retired from the Colombian army in 2019, according to the Colombian newspaper El Tiempo. Eladio Uribe's wife told the newspaper that he had been investigated for participation in the execution of civilians, a practice known as false positives, in which the Colombian military lured at least 6,402 civilians, murdered them, and dressed them in guerrilla fatigues in order to inflate their kill numbers. This gruesome practice helped military commanders reach lofty kill count quotas set by the United States and was intensified with bonus pay and vacation time for soldiers who carried out the killings. Eladio Uribe's wife said that he had been exonerated. His name has appeared in a file of the Special Jurisdiction for Peace, a court formed out of the 2016 Peace Accord, which has investigated several thousand cases of false positives that the Colombian government had not previously admitted. Eladio Uribe is one of the two soldiers accused in the 2008 murder of Luis Carlos Cardenas in the village of Cores Blancos in the region. Of the 28 total people who allegedly participated in the assassination, four of the Colombians arrived in Haiti on June 6, 2021. Grosso arrived in the Dominican city of Punta Cana and crossed the land border into Haiti 2 days later. Photos show him and other suspects at popular tourist sites in the Dominican Republic. Questions also remain about why MOA's security team failed to protect him, and if any of its members were complicit in the murder. Dimitri Herard, the head of the General Security Unit of the National Palace, is under investigation by the United States government for arms trafficking, according to the Center for Economic and Policy Research, CEPR. While there is no evidence, but many rumors linking him to the murder, Herard is one of the individuals most responsible for the safety of the president. While the Haitian government has identified what appear to be MOA's assassins, there's still no hard evidence, just circumstantial, linking them to Boulos and possibly even Borbe. Nonetheless, there is a growing consensus that Reginald Boulos, for whom an arrest warrant was issued recently, paid for the mercenaries, according to Eves. It appears to be becoming more and more evident that the sector of the Haitian bourgeois with whom MOA was at war are intimately linked to his assassination. As the investigation into MOA's murder unfolds, the U.S. appears to be preparing the groundwork to deploy troops to Haiti at the request of a figure whom it has spent decades grooming. According to the New York Times, Claude Joseph, who is in a struggle against Dr. Ariel Henry to head the Haitian state in the wake of MOA's assassination, requested the U.S. send military forces to guard key infrastructure, including the port, airport, and gasoline reserves. White House spokeswoman Jen Psaki announced that the U.S. would reinforce U.S. personnel in Haiti with FBI and DHS deployments. Joseph is an asset of the United States and its regime change arm, the National Endowment for Democracy. WikiLeaks cables revealed that he first came to prominence in 2003 as the leader of NED-spawned student front called GRAFNEH in the lead-up to the coup against President Jean-Bertrand Aristide. He also founded another NED-funded anti- Aristide Group initiative called Citizens Initiative. He's reported by Haitian radio stations to have been with prominent Haitian ex-deputy Gary Boudot, one of the principal assailants who severely beat the late father Gerald Jean Just in church in 2005. Jean Just, perhaps the most prominent supporter and surrogate of then-exiled in South Africa present Aristide, had been falsely accused of involvement in the killing of his own cousin, Jacques Roche, a writer. Essentially, we have a U.S. puppet asking his puppeteer to invade Haiti for the fourth time in just over a century, Eves concluded. But both the region and above all, the Haitian people are sick and tired of U.S. military interventions, which are largely responsible for the nation's current debilitated critical state both economically and politically. Much of the most oppressed neighborhoods are now heavily armed and have already announced a revolution against the likes of Boulos, so the U.S.-led invaders of 2021 are likely to face a resistance similar to that which emerged against the U.S. Marines in 1915 and U.N. peacekeepers in 2004, only more ferocious.
Yugoslavia from a historical standpoint.
Part 1.
Yugoslav President Slobodan Milosevic. Milosevic reigned over what was left of Yugoslavia as it fell apart in the 1990s, surviving crippling UN sanctions, wars in Slovenia, Croatia, and Bosnia, violent Albanian separatism in Kosovo, NATO airstrikes against his country, an ICTY war crimes indictment, and 40 years of marriage with a control freak wife, Milosevic was definitely a force to be reckoned with. Brutal towards his opponents at home and abroad, this banker, who at one time worked in New York City as a representative of the Yugoslav bank Belbanka, where he even met American banker David Rockefeller, seemed to not really care about the economic trends that were spreading in the region. Strobe Talbot, Deputy Secretary of State under U.S. President Bill Clinton and the lead U.S. negotiator during the Kosovo War, said that as nations throughout the region sought to reform their economies, mitigate ethnic tensions, and broaden civil society, Belgrade seemed to delight in continually moving in the opposite direction. It was Yugoslavia's resistance to the broader trends of political and economic reform, not the plight of the Kosovar Albanians, that best explains NATO's war.
As long as Milosevic remains in control, the international community will have little influence over what happens in Belgrade.
Since Milosevic didn't want to give up or share his control over the economy with anyone else, he needed to go. And he needed to go fast. Just like this guy, and 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 many others. But it was 2000, elections in Yugoslavia were just around the corner, and it was Milosevic's turn to go. This is me, protesting against Milosevic in my hometown of Subotica, Yugoslavia in 2000. I was a kid, and all I wanted was for my country to be more open, more accepted in the world community. And I wasn't alone. Since the early 1990s, there were many mass demonstrations against Milosevic, and they were led by opposition leaders such as Vuk Drašković and Zoran Đinđić. Under Milosevic, crime and corruption was around every corner, and many of his policies were extremely damaging for the people. Millions in Yugoslavia thought that if we're friendly towards the West, we'd quickly live just like they do. But to overthrow someone like Milosevic, you needed a serious team to get the job done.
Hello, I'm Marović, Ivan Marović. In 2000, my friends and I brought down Slobodan Milošević.
Make repression work for you. Make craziness the norm. 10,000 people in the street is news. 10 people in the street is obviously not news. But 10 people in the street doing something crazy, now that's news.
This guy made a revolution happen? You've got to be kidding me. There had to have been more to it. And there was. During the Cold War, the U.S. government loved to interfere in the domestic affairs of other countries. Among others, this was the task of the National Endowment for Democracy, or NED, which was basically a CIA spin-off. Before the elections in September of 2000 in Yugoslavia, the U.S. government made it clear again and again that a victory by Milosevic could only have come about through fraud. In other words, irrespective of how anyone voted, Washington would only accept one result as the democratic will of the people. In 1998, Paul McCarthy testified before the Commission on Security and Cooperation in Europe. McCarthy, a program officer at the NED, boasted that among the many recipients of NED money were the newspapers Naša Borba, Vreme, and Danas, an independent TV station in eastern Serbia, TV Negotin, the prominent news agency Beta, and the important Belgrade station, Radio B92. One of the organizations that were supported by the NED and many other Western interest groups was the Serbian youth organization Otpor, meaning resistance in Serbian. Ivan Marović, the tropical island-loving revolutionary, was one of the founders of Otpor, together with Serge Popović, Slobodan Homen, Nenad Konstantinović, Slobodan Džinović, Ivan Andrić, and Dejan Ranđić. Of the almost $3 million spent by the NED in Serbia since September of 1998, according to Paul McCarthy, Otpor was the largest recipient. The U.S. Agency for International Development, or USAID, said that $25 million was appropriated to Yugoslavia in 2000. The International Republican Institute, another non-governmental Washington group, according to official Daniel Kalingert, met with Otpor leaders 7 to 10 times in Hungary and Montenegro, beginning in October 1998. Some of the $1.8 million the institute spent in Serbia was provided directly to Otpor. By the fall of 2000, Otpor was no ramshackle students group. It was a well-oiled movement backed by several million dollars from the United States. But the Americans gave more than just money. Kalingert's organization arranged for a seminar at the luxurious Budapest Hilton from March to April 2000, where a retired U.S. Army colonel, Robert Helvey, instructed more than 20 Otpor leaders in the techniques of resistance.
Basically, it's techniques in provocation. Basically, it's a matter of doing things that will provoke the existing government to use force to stop whatever it is you're doing.
However, Otpor was just the muscle. There needed to be an actual opposition. For that purpose, the National Democratic Institute, or NDI, which works under the NED umbrella, opened an office in Belgrade in 1997. And by 1999, the NDI had already trained over 900 party leaders and activists. Western officials met with leaders of Serbian opposition parties, urging them to unite behind one presidential candidate. The Washington Post reported that 20 opposition leaders accepted an invitation from the NDI in October of 1999 to a seminar at the Marriott Hotel in Budapest. The U.S. polling firm Penn Schön & Berland Associates commissioned an opinion poll on the local politicians in Yugoslavia. According to the poll, Slobodan Milosevic had a 70% unfavorable rating among Serbian voters. However, the problem was that the big names in the opposition, like Zoran Đinđić and Vuk Drašković, had negative poll ratings as well, almost as high as Milosevic's. So, a lesser-known candidate who had never cooperated with Milosevic, unlike many other opposition leaders, became Milosevic's challenger, Vojislav Koštunica, in front of the Democratic Opposition of Serbia, or DOS, which united most of the bigger opposition parties. On September 24th, 2000, elections were held in Yugoslavia and Vojislav Koštunica won more votes than Slobodan Milosevic. However, the Federal Electoral Committee declared that Koštunica didn't have more than 50% of the votes needed for an outright victory, and that a second round between Koštunica and Milosevic was to be held on October 8th. The Democratic opposition accused Milosevic of stealing the elections, and they were backed up by much of the West.
Opposition politicians have produced evidence of electoral fraud in Kosovo to support claims that their candidate, Vojislav Koštunica, won an outright victory in last Sunday's presidential election.
All available information points to a clear lead by the democratic opposition of Serbia's Koštunica.
Today, Milosevic is a beaten, broken-backed president. We know he was preparing to rig the results. My message to him today, get out of the way and let Serbia get out of the prison into which you have turned it.
The Serbian state-run television saw it differently. The democratic opposition refused to participate in the second round and called for a general strike.
Tens of thousands have answered the call of the democratic opposition of Serbia for a five-day campaign of civil disobedience. The mass protests have already begun in Belgrade and other cities. Strikes and boycotts are also planned in a concerted effort to force Milosevic to accept the opposition's general election victory.
On October 5th, 2000, the final mass demonstration in Belgrade included an assault on the federal parliament and radio television Serbia, led by a group of specially trained squads of former soldiers. They were followed by a mob of DOS supporters who rampaged through the building, smashing furniture and computers, and setting the parliament ablaze. Budding gardening enthusiasts and plant collectors also seized the opportunity to get in on the action. After radio television Serbian Belgrade was seized, it too was torched. Milosevic was history. Democracy and freedom had come to Yugoslavia. I grew up in a small town where family came first. I don't remember much when I was very young during the socialist Yugoslavia, but I know my family didn't have much in terms of material goods, and yet they were happy. We got most of our food locally from the farms surrounding Subotica. The education and medical care was free, our passports were welcome at every border, and many hard workers had decent jobs. My dad worked as a legal advisor at Sever, a company selling top-notch electric motors to companies in Yugoslavia and the world. This is where he met my mom. They fell in love and later married. Oh, and they had me, of course. That's when things got interesting. In the 1990s, I remember my dad traveling around the world, being a member of the executive board of the company's representative headquarters in Denmark, Germany, Italy, Hungary, Macedonia, and the United States, where Sever, among other places, exported its high-quality products. Though Sever stagnated for a while during the 80s, under the new CEO Josip Kreininger, who was appointed in 1990, the company was expanding and becoming a world-class multinational corporation. Wow, one of those from Yugoslavia. Neat. But then in 1992, the UN imposed sanctions. Trade with the world suddenly became a big no-no. The export of Sever's products continued via Macedonia, where a company was founded under a different name. Let me allow that to sink in. Not even a wide-scale NATO bombing campaign, led by the United States, could stop a successful company like Sever. Josip Kreininger was someone who loved his company with all his heart, and was able to not only keep it alive, but to keep it growing, despite war, sanctions, and bombings. But there was one thing Sever couldn't survive. As Mr. Kreininger watched the parliament and state television buildings burn on television on October 5th, 2000, Mr. Kreininger, who wasn't a member of any political party, was worried about his country, but also optimistic. Sever was finally ready to become a multinational corporation. But that's not what happened. Mr. Kreininger, in shock that he was replaced, ended up at the emergency room, diagnosed with heart troubles and given disability pension after 6 months. During the 34 years of work at Sever, this man never took a single sick day. A broken heart, one might say, was the gift the new system had in store for those who wanted to keep the domestic industry's heart beating. Sever had over 4,000 employees in the year 2000. After being sold to the Austrian company ATB in 2014, it had just 370 employees. However, in the next 3 months, by the end of 2000, Serbia had an average increase of prices by 52%. Thanks to stabilization, many domestic companies which could do good business had to close down. That's how many of the other domestic companies were destroyed, as they couldn't compete with subsidized foreign goods, many at dumping prices, so they too had to be closed down. With many companies closed down and destroyed, they were now being sold off by the state. Hold on, who were the genius masterminds behind all this? I had a chance to chat with Dinkić in 2012 after a press conference in my hometown of Subotica. But Dinkić didn't give up on the Washington consensus until it was too late. Under the rule of the post-Milosevic Prime Minister Zoran Đinđić, attracting foreign investors was priority number one. So, many of the first firms offered on sale were intentionally assigned a book value of one-third of their true value. Sharply reduced tax rates were offered as further inducement for foreign investors. Yugoslavia was finally open for business. And employment was something Dinkić and his colleagues cared a lot about. Companies that were privatized first showed a decrease of 45% in employment over the first 2 years of private ownership. Instead of caring for the workers, the government actually decided to speed up the layoffs and came up with a new law requiring staff to be sacked prior to sale in order to attract investors. Unemployment in Serbia steadily grew, quickly reaching 32% within 4 years. By 2012, it stood at 24%. Sounds better? Nope, just an illusion, because Serbia adopted the modern American model for calculating unemployment, labeling those who weren't actively seeking jobs as merely out of the job market and technically not unemployed, even though they still had no jobs. If you included those, the real unemployment rate was at 34%. To put this in perspective, at its peak in 1933, unemployment during the Great Depression in the United States reached 25%, and that percentage was calculated in the old way. That didn't exclude a significant portion of workers. The West isolating and attacking Yugoslavia from 1992 to 2000 did great harm to the economy, but it seems that the West supposedly helping Yugoslavia as of 2000 made many things even worse. Why? From a historical standpoint, this made more sense.
Is it Greece? No. Is it the French Riviera? No. Is it Turkey? Austria? Switzerland? Rome? No. It's all Yugoslavia. A fascinating blend of all that attracts the traveler to Europe.
The country itself can best be described as the best of Europe.
Revi English Radio, a window to peace of mind and spirituality. You can tune in to Revi English Radio 24 hours a day. We are with you. Are you with us? Are you with us? Are you with us? This is our voice from the heart of the Islamic Republic of Iran, Revi English Radio.
The limelight.
More than 60 wildfires were burning across at least 10 states in the parched American West on Tuesday, 13th of July, with the largest in Oregon, consuming an area nearly twice the size of Portland. The fires have torched homes and forced thousands of people to evacuate from Alaska to Wyoming, according to the National Interagency Fire Center. Arizona, Idaho, and Montana accounted for more than half of the large active fires. The article you're about to hear has been written by staff at the British newspaper The Guardian. The piece is titled, More Than 60 Wildfires Rage Across U.S. West, Including Blaze Bigger Than Portland. Stay with us for more. More than 60 wildfires were burning across at least 10 states in the parched American West on Tuesday, 13th of July, with the largest in Oregon, consuming an area nearly twice the size of Portland. The wildfires have torched homes and forced thousands of people to evacuate from Alaska to Wyoming, according to the National Interagency Fire Center. Arizona, Idaho, and Montana accounted for more than half of the large active fires. The fires erupted as the West was in the grip of the second bout of dangerously high temperatures in just a few weeks. A major drought, exacerbated by the climate crisis, is contributing to conditions that make wildfires even more dangerous, according to scientists. The National Weather Service says the heat wave appeared to have peaked in many areas, and excessive heat warnings were largely expected to expire by Tuesday. However, they continued into Tuesday night in some California deserts, and many areas were still expected to see highs in the 80s and 90s. In Northern California, a combined pair of lightning-ignited blazes, dubbed the Beckwith Complex, is now 46% contained, according to an incident report. Firefighters spent days battling flames that were fueled by winds, hot weather, and low humidity that sapped the moisture from vegetation. Evacuation orders were in place for more than 3,000 residents of remote northern areas and neighboring Nevada. There were reports of burnt homes, but damage was still being tallied. The blaze had consumed 140 square miles or 362 square kilometers of land, including in Plumas National Forest. A fire that began on Sunday, 11th of July, in Sierra Nevada, south of the Yosemite National Park, exploded over 14 square miles or 36 square kilometers and was just 10% contained. The largest fire in the United States lay across the California border in southwestern Oregon. The bootleg fire, which doubled and doubled again over the weekend, threatened some 2,000 homes, state fire officials said. It had burnt at least 7 homes and more than 40 other buildings. Tim McCarley told KPTV that he and his family were ordered to flee their home on Friday with flames just minutes behind them. They told us to leave our home because if we didn't, we'd be dead, he said. He described the blaze as like a firenado, with flames leaping dozens of feet into the air and jumping around, catching trees and then just explosions. The fire was burning in the Fremont-Winema National Forest near the Kalamath County town of Sprague River. It has ravaged an area of about 240 square miles, that is 620 square kilometers, or nearly twice the size of Portland. Firefighters hadn't managed to surround any of it as they struggled to build containment lines. The fire drastically disrupted service on three transmission lines, providing up to 5,500 megawatts of electricity to California. And California's power grid operator has repeatedly asked for voluntary power conservation during evening.